Now, we were speaking yesterday about number 10, the Arminian Calvinist dispute, and we noticed the situation, the background of these disputes. And we noticed how it flared up between the Wesleys and Whitfield, but did not last between them. Because the Wesleys and Whitfield, all three of them, had their eyes on that for which God has called men, has leads Christian people in this world, to win others to the Lord, to teach them to know Him and to grow in grace. And while Whitfield felt very strong that the doctrines that he believed in were true and vital, and Christians derived tremendous encouragement and help from knowing them, and he felt very badly ever to hear them criticized. And while Wesley felt that some were taking those doctrines and carrying them to an extreme, which resulted in a lethargy and a failure to do what the Lord wanted one to do, and an attitude that was wrong and unchristian, and certainly though Wesley did not realize it, utterly uncharacteristic of Calvin's real attitude. Though they both felt this way, there was the two men, the three men, were on the warmest of fellowship as long as they lived, though some of their followers came into rather strong hostility during their lives. But after Whitfield's death, then we find among the followers very strong and bitter animosities. And of course, there were some who simply stood on the sidelines and attacked the doctrines of the other, but there were a larger number who did not put this primary, but on both sides, who did the work that the Lord wanted them to, even while spending part of their time in very acrimonious disputes. And one of those I mentioned at the end of the hour is Augustus Toplady. And I think it is good we should be aware of this great Christian man, Augustus Toplady. I believe, have seen his name many times because of that wonderful hymn that he wrote, Rock of Ages. And he wrote a number of other very wonderful hymns. He was a great preacher of righteousness, a great winner of souls. And when you read what there is, there's not a great, but what there is of his sermons and of his Christian hymns, you see what a great Christian he was. On the other hand, he is one who allowed his zeal for the sovereignty of God to lead him to speak, go very harshly into criticism of those who differed with it in a way that I think was very unfortunate. Mr. Paul?
It's just interesting to know that Rock of Ages was originally a word taken right out of one of the Wesley hymns.
Rock of Ages?
It was actually a play against that very hymn. Right?
I didn't know that. I know that it was in one of his controversial writings, the first appear. And of course, Charles Wesley wrote thousands of hymns, and some very wonderful hymns too. And while Charles Wesley had an idea of Calvinism, which was built upon those who made the sovereignty of God an excuse for inaction, either inaction in trying to escape from sin, and realizing your inability and your need of a Savior, or in after one was knew that he was a child of God, in failing to do everything he could to win true sanctification and to proceed, saying that simply, well, God will take care of it. This, what they called antinomianism, that though Charles Wesley felt that these were very strong dangers, yet if you go through his hymns, you find that the great central note in Charles Wesley's hymn is not anything man is going to do, but it is what God has done. What God will do for the seeking soul who comes to Him through faith in Christ alone. But we go on to number 11, which is Wesley's relation to the established church. Wesley's relation to the established church. Under this, small a and b, we have already really discussed, but we'll reiterate and touch upon them here. And for the completeness of the outline, it's good to put them down. Small a then is Wesley's attitude. And Wesley's attitude on this, as on all points which he did not consider primary, as we've noticed, was simply a conservative attitude. Wesley was raised in the established church. Wesley simply took the doctrine of the established church, not simply as stated in its doctrinal statements, but as generally held in the attitudes of the church when he was a boy. And Wesley was sincerely devoted to all that in which he had been brought up. But into this there was inserted that tremendous thing of his realization of justification by faith. His realization of the tremendous grace of God, for the fact that no one can win salvation, but that God is anxious to give it to all who come through Christ to him. And so Wesley is a man who is a conservative on anything which he did not feel to be so primary and so related to his central attitudes that it is tremendously affected by them. Thus we find Wesley endorsing the divine right of kings, taking that sensuous and rather low type of man, George II, who was on the throne of England during most of his Wesley's life, and referring to him as the wonderful one whom God has established over the nation, and speaking so highly of him at his death, and so on, and writing words of expostulation to the Americans when the Revolutionary War broke out about their folly in turning against a great and noble prince like George III, whom they had. These matters were not simple to the great change that had been made in Wesley's life through his conversion, and on them he simply followed his conservative attitude. And he followed the doctrinal attitude of the church, and he also believed this was the church established of God, the Church of England, established of God for England. And so he always insisted they must never have services at any time, except at any time when the Church of England had services. He would hold services at 5 in the morning, or he would hold them late in the evening, or he would hold them during the afternoon, but whenever the Church of England held the service, he would never do anything that could be an excuse for any of his people not to go to the meetings of the Church of England. And toward the end of his life, Wesley declared, "I was born in the Church of England, I shall die in the Church of England." He insisted on his great loyalty to the Church of England. That was Wesley's attitude. Now, that attitude came smack up against small b, the attitude of the bishops. And there were one or two bishops, like the Bishop of Gloucester, who had ordained Whitfield, looked with favor during a good bit of the time at the work of these men who were winning so many to the Lord. Although you remember, even the Bishop of Gloucester had at one time been so influenced when people asked him to talk to the Countess of Huntington and tried to keep her from throwing her influence and giving her money to the support of Whitfield and the Wesleys, the Methodists, as they called all of these itinerant preachers. Benson, when he talked with the Countess of Huntington, told her that the thing he regretted in his life above all else was that he had ordained Whitfield to the ministry. And she said to him, she says, "Before your death, you will reach the point where you will feel it was the finest thing you ever did in your life." And later on, the Bishop of Gloucester did say that he was so happy he had ordained Whitfield, and he felt so grateful for the attitude that the Countess of Huntington continued to take, even against his strong expostulations. But among the bishops at this time, there were many who happened to be younger brothers of a wealthy duke, or people of some particular family that wanted to find a cinch office for their member of the family where they'd receive a good income without having to do much work. Many of the positions in the church were simply that way, or political plums handed out by the government. And so there were many very worldly bishops, and naturally they were against anything like this. They called it enthusiasm. That was far worse than heresy in their eyes, was enthusiasm. And then there were a few bishops who were very godly men and very interested from an intellectual viewpoint in as upholding the truth of Christianity, but who felt that this enthusiasm was bad, and this breaking the rules of the church by preaching outside a church building or doing things that were not an established part of the church work. And one of these, of course, was the great Bishop Butler, who wrote The Analogy of Religion, a work that did so much to defend Christianity against attacks whenever I have a chance. And then, of course, Wesley said, after all, I wasn't ordained by a particular bishop. I'm a fellow of Lincoln College in Oxford, and I was consequently ordained not for any one particular diocese. But this refusal of the established church to cooperate with the Wesleys made it difficult for the Wesleys to cooperate with the church. Whitfield didn't face this problem much because he was not an organizer like the Wesleys, and he spent half his time in America, and he was going here and there and helping all sorts of movements and groups, presenting the true word of God everywhere he could get a hearing, but not doing so much to build a work. But Wesley was going back repeatedly to different areas, seeing how the converts were coming, changing their leadership, rebuking those who had fallen into sin, trying to encourage them to work in reaching others, and he found it a great problem, the refusal of the established church to cooperate, and in fact, its efforts to interfere. During his early ministry, many times, the local ministers were the ones who stirred up the mobs against him. Although this ceased after 20 years or so, when his work had become better established. Now, a third problem, which, as far as Wesley's concerned, or a third point, C, which, as far as he's concerned, was much more important than bringing about a break, was C, the difficulty of securing ordained help. Before long, Wesley had a fairly sizable group of ministers of the Church of England who were helping him. And Whitfield also had some who were helping him. But as the work grew, the number of ordained ministers they had working with them was much too small for the many calls for preaching and the many opportunities to start. He wouldn't say churches. Wesley felt the Church of England was the church. They never build a church, they build a chapel, or they build a meeting house, a place to develop the spiritual life for the church. Of course, they should go to the Church of England. But they wanted to have certain things that only an ordained man could give, and they also wanted the trained understanding that required the education that an ordained man would be expected to have, and they had a number of very earnest helpers who had this education, but the number was far below the number they needed. And the result was that they began setting apart men simply to be local preachers or exhorters. And these men, when Wesley or one of his associated ministers could not get to a place for 6 months, these men might read some of Wesley's sermons for a while, do that sort of thing, but inevitably they would reach the point where they were giving expositions of the scripture and sermons themselves, and inevitably the time came when they felt a very great need of having an ordained man. And so this difficulty grew, and Wesley, facing the difficulty and studying the scripture and reading the church fathers, reached the conclusion that the presbyter and the bishop are actually the same office. He found that St. Jerome had held that view, that the presbyter is a term for his character. He is an elder. He's a man of experience. He is also a bishop, that is an overseer. It's the Greek word, overseer, bishop. That describes his duty to watch over the flock for the Lord, while presbyter describes his qualification to be a man more experienced in the Christian life and more highly trained. And so Wesley said he would not in any way oppose the government of the Church of England, which he didn't think was contrary to the scripture. And he would not take upon himself any of the duties or the claims, the rights of a bishop, which he had not been ordained to in the church. But he said, nevertheless, it is a fact that the bishop and the elder are the same office. And this is purely a matter of expediency that the Church of England has followed this other practice. And so he said, when there is a need like up in Scotland, where there were a certain number of people in Scotland who they had organized into groups, and these people needed an ordained man, and he said, the Church of England cannot have any jurisdiction in Scotland, naturally. And he said, you're not in any way interfering with the Church of England to appoint ministers for these groups. And so he said, I feel that I have the authority to appoint ministers and to ordain them, that I am a together with the Church of England was to appoint some ministers for Scotland. There was no great need of his appointing ministers for Scotland, because most of the Scotch were loyal to the Church of Scotland, which was a thoroughly Calvinistic Presbyterian church. And then there was a small group in Scotland which had been won to the Church of England during the time of the persecution, and now they had a continuing Episcopal church in Scotland, which was not the church. You couldn't have the Church of England in Scotland, and it wasn't the Church of Scotland, but it was carrying on the practices and viewpoints of the Church of England. It was a small group, but a group of people who were very strongly held this view. So between these two, there was not a great number in Scotland, nothing like his work in England, but yet enough that he felt that to set apart three or four men to go up to Scotland and be ministers for these, he felt was a worthy thing. And so he ordained these men to be ministers for Scotland, but he was very strict. They were reverend so-and-so when they were in Scotland, but the minute they got back to England, they were ministers, because they were then in the territory of the Church of England, and they could no longer be considered as ministers. But you see how gradually, against his will, he was being pushed into a position where he was having to oppose or to do things that really made a separation from the Church of England. But the thing that really forced the separation was the development of the work in America. We look at that under number 10. The separation of Methodists from Anglicans. The separation of Methodists from Anglicans. Yes? 12. Thank you. Your mathematics better than mine. Thank you very much. Number 12, the separation of Methodists from Anglicans. As some of Wesley's followers, of course, Whitfield had done a tremendous work in America. But Whitfield had started no separate churches in America. The Church of England in America had cooperated very little with Whitfield. Some of the other churches had opposed him at first, but most of them had come to rejoice in Whitfield's work, and Whitfield preached in Presbyterian and Baptist churches and congregational churches all over America, and contributed greatly to the strengthening of these churches. Whitfield, there's no evidence that Whitfield ever in any way cooperated with people who denied the deity of Christ or denied the necessity of the atonement for salvation. There's no evidence of any kind of cooperation of that sort on his part. But lesser doctrinal differences, while Whitfield very strongly felt what he believed, yet he felt that the great thing was fulfilling the Great Commission and winning souls to the Lord and teaching them to grow in grace and in the knowledge of the Lord, and in cooperation with any others who felt also that that was primary, Whitfield was ready to work energetically. And he worked up and down the coast of what is now the United States year after year, because up to his death in 1770, just 5 years before the Revolutionary War, when at the age of 54, he was up in Massachusetts, and after he was health was in rather bad condition, he preached during the day, and he retired for the night, and people thronged about calling for a sermon. And he came to the steps and stood on the steps upstairs of the building, and they opened the door, and they filled in the vestibule downstairs, and out in front, the large crowd gathered, and he held a candle in his hand, and he preached until the candle burned clear down to the bottom, and then went back upstairs, lay down, and an hour later he was dead. And he was buried there in Massachusetts. But Wesley had a number of his followers who came to America and stayed here, and who went particularly out into the sections where there were no churches, and where there were poor people whom the churches had been paying no attention. And they went about to these people, preaching to them and bringing them copies of Wesley's sermons and copies of books of the Bible. And one of their leaders was a man named Asbury, A-S-B-U-R-Y. And so Wesley appointed Asbury to be a superintendent over, sort of a general superintendent over the work of building up societies for the development of spiritual life in America, and for time, Asbury was the, more or less the head of the Methodist work in America. Then after the Revolutionary War was over, in 1781, they felt the need of more helpers in America. They couldn't get enough ordained men. Asbury had no authority to ordain anyone, and a man who was a good organizer named Coke, C-O-K-E, they thought of sending to America to participate in the work, and Coke and Asbury wanted to be able to ordain other men to work in America from those they found here. They could not then ask the Church of England to ordain them because America was now independent. The Church of England had no authority in America, and anyway, they couldn't all afford to go over to England to be examined and ordained by the Church of England. And so they urged Wesley to ordain these men not simply as ministers for an area outside of England, but to ordain them to give them the authority to ordain others. And Wesley felt that this was a necessity, but he knew some of his associates would be very upset. And so even though Charles Wesley was right in the same town, he didn't tell Charles what he was doing. But privately, in a small meeting, he ordained Coke and Asbury as superintendents for the work in America, declaring that they would now have the authority to ordain others as ministers for America. Yes? He was ordained as a deacon and a priest in the Anglican Church, but not as a bishop. No. He did not have the authority to ordain others. And his first step in that direction, you see, was when he ordained men for Scotland. And he explained that by saying that a bishop and an elder, after all, were identical in the ancient church. And he was an elder. That was the way he explained it, but he only did it very little. With his most of his people, either were ministers who were ordained in the Church of England, or people whom he considered merely as local preachers and not ordained. But he did ordain a few for Scotland. And then this was a second step, not to ordain a man as a minister, but to ordain a man as having the authority to ordain others as ministers. And that, when he first ordained anyone as a minister, in fact, when he began to preach outdoors, his older brother Samuel, who was a man of very high character, a rector in the Episcopal Church, and devoted to the attitude of his parents, Samuel was ready to utterly disown John. He felt this was terribly wicked to do these things. Well, now Charles, too, was quite incensed at what John did. He couldn't see how he could give a man the authority to ordain other men. And I'm not sure John fully realized how far it was going himself, because it was after this that he declared he was loyal to the Church of England, he was born in it, he would die in it, he would never in any way separate from it. But he did this. Charles said, these are not proper ordinations. He said, an ordination has to be done by a bishop. He said, this is John is not a bishop. He said, furthermore, an ordination has to be done in a public church service, and John did this privately in a little room shut up apart with only five or six people there. He said, this is utterly irregular. Charles was very much disgusted with John over it. Yes? Yes. They were simply, John Wesley called them superintendents. And he had already previously made Asbury a sort of a general superintendent for the work, thinking of him simply as one who oversaw the work of others. But now he made them specifically superintendents for the work in America. And then when these two, they came to the United States, and Asbury continued for many years very active in building up Methodist churches in America. Coke was constantly traveling back and forth. It was tremendous that Whitfield made 7 trips to America. I think Coke made 13. He was constantly going back and forth, and he made a very important liaison between the English church and the American, and doubtless there were many problems that came. directed the work and tried to extend it and build it up. And Cook and Asbury soon found that when they would tell people they were the superintendent of the Methodist Church, that the people didn't quite understand what a superintendent meant. Just what is a superintendent? What is the point of it anyway? After all, they were accustomed to that, even if they didn't belong to the Church of England, they knew about it. They had priests in the church, deacons and priests, which of course abbreviation of presbyter, and they had bishops. But what was this superintendent business? And so Cook and Asbury quit calling themselves superintendents and began calling themselves bishops. And Wesley, when he heard of that, was very, very indignant. And so he wrote a letter to Asbury, and he said, "At one point, my dear brother, I'm a little afraid both Dr. Cook and you differ from me. I study to be little, you study to be great. I creep, you strut along. I found a school, you a college. Nay, and call it after your own names, Cokesbury," Cook and Asbury together. He said, "One instance of your greatness has given me great concern. How can you, how dare you, suffer yourself to be called bishop? I shudder, I start at the very thought. Men may call me a knave, a fool, a rascal, a scoundrel, and I'm content, but they shall never by my consent call me a bishop. For my sake, for God's sake, put a full end to all this. Let the Presbyterians do what they please, but let the Methodists know their calling best. Thus, my dear Frankie, I've told you all that is in my heart." And so this is the way that Wesley felt about their taking the title bishop. But in spite of Wesley's desires, the fact was that what he started as simply organization to develop the spiritual life had developed into a separate church. The leaders of the Anglican Church didn't particularly want it. To a large extent, they were drawn from a different social class, from that which made up the greater part of the leadership of the Anglican Church in England and almost all of it in America at that time. And of course, and their attitudes made such an interference that if the work went forward, they really had to step out on their own feet. And the result was that though Charles Wesley and John Wesley always remained loyal to the Church of England, after Wesley's death, you had a different organization which soon began holding its services at the same time as those of the Church of England. And in America, they adopted the name the Methodist Episcopal Church. And of course, Episcopal means having bishops. The Methodist simply means the descendants of the movement started by the Wesleys and Whitfield in Oxford that was ridiculed by others for their methodical methods of life by being called Methodists. And Episcopal means under the control of bishops. But the accidentally, you might say, it developed that Wesley was absolute dictator in the Methodist work in England. His education was way ahead of all of his associates, his ability, his leadership, and time and again a problem would come up and Wesley could see in a second what the best way to deal with it was. Other people would see the answer if you'd spend 6 hours arguing with them. And it was easier to just say it than to spend the 6 hours arguing. And while there were occasions when Wesley went into things in great detail, people got into the habit of simply taking his authority on everything, and whatever he said was done. And so it developed that the Methodist Church, minister, I remember when I was a boy hearing that a Methodist minister and one member of the congregation could outvote all the rest, and that the bishop and one minister could outvote all the other ministers in an area. It's a military type of organization which developed by accident, you might say, through Wesley's great leadership. And it is the most ideal and wonderful type of organization for rapid work and effective accomplishment. If you can only have superhuman men, both in ability and in sanctity as bishops, they can work things out in such a way as to move forward rapidly, to build up rapidly, and to accomplish a tremendous great deal. But once you get bad men into the position, once you get unbelievers into the position, it can turn just as rapidly to a source of evil as it was a source of great good when it was being used by good men. And the result is that the Methodist Church perhaps grew faster than any other church in America, and it accomplished a tremendous amount. And once modernists got control, they were able to swing it more rapidly than any other church in America over to complete support of an entirely different viewpoint and attitude than that which the Wesleys had maintained at all. But now we must go on to capital G. Capital G is the results of the evangelical revival. And the results of the evangelical revival are, number one, the foundation of the Methodist churches. Now, the Methodist church never grew to be a great church in Scotland. In Scotland, the bulk of the people, in fact, nearly all the people, were devoted to their Presbyterian churches, which they called the Church of Scotland. There were some groups that had broken away from it, called themselves by other names. But most of the people of Scotland were settled in these Presbyterian churches, and a small Methodist church developed in Scotland. In New England, the Methodist church did not grow to any great extent for a very long time, because the Congregational churches, the successors of the Puritans who had come to New England, were were so widely extended and so dominant in the area. But in the newly settled areas of the United States, and among the large unchurched masses of England, the Methodist Church grew to be quite a large institution, which for many years did a very great work for God. But so the foundation of the Methodist churches is the most obvious result of the evangelical revival, but perhaps not its greatest result. So we go on to number two. The reawakening of evangelical fervor in many denominations. The evangelical revival of the 18th century did not merely establish the Methodist churches, it affected all churches in Great Britain and in the United States. In the United States, the terrible effects of the reigns of Charles II and James II had not had much effect here, so that the United States had never sunk into the condition that England had. But in England, all the churches practically had dried up and become practically nothing during those years, except forms. And the evangelical revival resulted in a great many men in all the different churches being stirred and moved and cooperated with Dwight Whitfield and with the Wesleys, and starting new institutions and training up their children and having effect in many ways, so that the influence went out very, very wide. One way we'll call small A here, the evangelical party in the Church of England. As a result of the work of these men, Whitfield, with his great meetings that the Countess of Huntington had opened up for him, where he met many of the leaders of thought and the leaders of English life, won many of them to an out-and-out loyalty to the Lord without their making any change in their denominational alliance. And many of the Presbyterian leaders in Scotland were greatly influenced by the leaders in different groups. But the evangelical party in the Church of England became a strong group which for a century and more was very, very active in England, and perhaps was almost as great a factor, maybe even a greater factor than the Methodist Church itself in the history of England in the next century. Then small b, we'll lump the dissenting churches together here, small b, but I have here Newman's Manual of Church History, A.H. Newman, who was a prominent American professor of church history in Baptist theological seminaries. And Newman, in his Baptist Church History here, says that the Baptist churches in England practically disappeared as far as being of any importance is concerned during the long reign, the 25-year reign of Charles II, followed by the 3 years of James II. They were, of course, it was illegal to hold services at all, and the result was that what little remained of what they called the general Baptists, that was the Arminian Baptists, he says practically all became says they retained their belief in the Bible, but unable to do any preaching or to reach people outside to any extent, they began arguing about minor points of Calvinism and figuring that the great important thing in life was to get the every T crossed and every I dotted in these regards, and nothing else mattered. And they had become a very small and insignificant and unimportant group as far as English life was concerned. But as a result of the work of Wesley's and Whitfield, new life was put into both of these groups. And both of these groups, which had fallen in numbers until they were extremely insignificant, began to become evangelistic and to begin to put their emphasis on the great things of the Word of God and began to develop and enlarge and to become real factors in English life. And so the great work that was done in the following century by the Baptist churches in England had its impetus from the evangelical revival. Now, number three, social reforms. The modernists love to talk about the making a better world and doing away with that which is bad and harmful in this world, and as if that was the real purpose of the church, was social reform. But the fact of the matter is that most of the social changes and improvements that have taken place in the world have taken place not through the efforts of unbelievers, not through the efforts of people of any other religion, not through the efforts of moderns, but as a byproduct of the work of earnest evangelical Christians. And practically every real social advance and improvement that has been made has come about through this. And so it was people who had been stirred by Whitfield and by the Wesleys who began to protest against the great numbers of hangings in England for often very minor causes, for the easy access to rum that resulted in the great majority of the people being sodden and drunk half the time, and the conditions that resulted from it, the widespread immorality, all of these various social things, the social evils. There is a book that was written about 25 years ago called England Before and After Wesley by J.W. Braid. And in this book, he tells quite a little about the evangelical revival, but he particularly shows the terrible low standards in social life in every way in England prior to it, and then what tremendous changes took place as a result of it. And they took place largely through the activity of men who had been stirred by the evangelical revival. And now we mentioned number four here, the general raising of moral standards. And it is almost unbelievable to read the literature of England at about 1700 with its very low standard of morality, with its utter ridiculing of any belief in there being in the decency or uprightness being valuable or worthwhile, and to compare it with the standard, the general standard of the literature of, say, 1850, when the everyone was anxious, no matter what their views were, that people would think that they believed in honesty and in decency and in morality. Now, it is customary in our day to try to, people like to look down their noses at what they call the Victorian age and to consider as if it was a period of utmost prudery and of a ridiculous attitude toward what is natural. Now, there doubtless was a fair measure of this. There were many people who were affected simply by external things rather than by the real central things that matter. But the fact is that the attitude of the result of the evangelical revival was an attitude that believed there are great moral principles that are vital, and that this came to be believed and felt by all segments of the population. And while it was carried out in some ways in ways that were artificial or that were not strongly biblically centered, yet the whole level of morality want to compare the attitude of the court of George II, for instance, with that of Queen Victoria. Victoria simply gives her name to this age because she happened to live a long time and was the occupied the position of sovereign. But it was nothing Victoria had done or anybody had done in her day. But the evangelical revival was now losing its force, but its results were still apparent, and its effect upon people and upon their children. And it's interesting, for instance, to read about a reporter tells of going to Oxford, I believe, one of the great universities, where George Eliot, you know, George Eliot was Mary Ann Evans, as she wrote under the pen name of George Eliot, and wrote a number of novels under that name. She was a free thinker. She was one who translated Strauss's Life of Jesus into English. She gave up all belief in Orthodox religion. But she was in many ways a child of the age. And this man tells about how she came and gave that talk at some group there. And after this reporter talked to her, and she said to him, she said, think of the three great words. She says, God, immortality, duty. She says, God, how inconceivable. Immortality, how unbelievable. But duty, how wonderful. He said she seemed to him like a great sibyl of old as she said these words. You just felt what duty meant to her. Now, how many people feel that way about duty today? Of course, it is a silly thing, actually, to take simply an ideal and put it up by itself as if it in itself meant something. But it is the result of the establishment of standards through the evangelical revival, which resulted in their spreading out through the parts of the population, even which were not directly affected by the Christian teaching. And so what is called the Victorian era is the result, as the force of the evangelical revival was declining, but as its byproducts were stretching out and were having many good effects and many that were somewhat distorted or somewhat twisted, but that were very definitely a reflection of it. Well, we looked at, this was G. Let's look at capital H. Capital H, conditions in America. Now, we won't say a great deal about America during this period beyond what we've already said, particularly in connection with Whitfield. But in America, capital H, conditions in America. I just wanted to briefly note the situation in America at the last half of the 18th century. And in America at this time, the results of the Puritan background, the results of the religious foundation of America, were very evident in the general character and attitude of the people as a whole. 50 years after this, Charles Dickens made a trip to America, and he didn't like America, because American publishers took his novels and reprinted them without giving him royalties. So he was very down on America, and later in his writings he ridicules the country and speaks very lightly of it. So he was not a man prejudiced in favor of America. But the Dickens says that when he came here and traveled rather widely, he was tremendously affected by the fact that a woman could go at any time of day or night through any town in America in perfect safety, and no one would think of molesting her. Quite different from conditions today. But it reflects the religious background of America. Now, there are people who will say, why you talk about the Christian background of America and how God has blessed the country, but they say, actually, the founders of America were not Christians, they were deists. Now, deism was a philosophical in England, which affected a number of the members of the educated classes, but which did not affect the people as a whole. There was nothing like the modernist movement of today in those days. That is, there was not a large movement of indoctrination of people against Christianity. There was simply indifference and worldliness and hypocrisy. But there was a small movement among some rather brilliant people who called themselves deists. And these deists believed that God created the world, somewhat like you'd make a watch and wound it up and then left it. And everything then is handled by simply by natural causes, natural working, and they did not believe in revealed religion. Now, among the intellectual leaders of America, there were those who were greatly attracted by these teachings, particularly perhaps Thomas Jefferson. And many people will talk as if one who was very particularly affected by them was Benjamin Franklin. Now, Benjamin Franklin doubtless was to some extent. And Benjamin Franklin's autobiography, he tells about how in his early days in Philadelphia, he went to a church and the minister was always preaching about little, very minor things, he said, that he thought was a waste of time to listen to. And then the minister announced the text, whatsoever things are good, think on these things. And he said, why, you can't help having a good sermon for this. And he said, the minister preaching, what are the good things that everyone should think of? Number one was going to church in the morning. Number two was going to the evening service. Number three was going to the prayer meeting. And it was just things like that. And he said he was so disgusted he quit attending the church. But some people have that attitude that the founders of America, of the United States, were deists rather than Christians. So I think it's very interesting, this book, Miracle at Philadelphia, Catherine Drinker Bowen's account of the great debate in the founding of the Constitution of the United States, tells how one day in the meeting, the Constitutional Convention, as they were trying to get these 13 colonies that had won their freedom from England to unite together into one nation, the representatives of 12 of these 13 came together to try to make a plan. And one day, Franklin got up. He was in his 80s now. Most of them average about 30 in age, but he was in his 80s. He got up, and he addressed Washington, who was presiding, and Franklin said, the small progress we've made after 4 or 5 weeks' close attendance and continual reasonings with each other, our different sentiments on almost every question, producing almost as many no's as us, is, methinks, a melancholy proof of the imperfection of the human understanding. We indeed seem to feel our own want of political wisdom since we've been running about in search of it. And he went on and told how badly he felt about the way things were going. He said, in this situation of the assembly, groping as it were in the dark to find political truth and scarce able to distinguish it when presented to us, how has it happened, sir, that we have not hitherto once thought of humbly applying to the Father of Lights to illumine our understanding? Then he referred back to the war with England. He says, our prayers, sir, were heard, and they were graciously answered. All of us who were engaged in the struggle must have observed frequent instances of a superintending providence in our favor. To that kind providence, we owe this happy opportunity of consulting in peace on the means of establishing our future national felicity. And have we now forgotten that powerful friend? I have lived, sir, a long time, and the longer I live, the more convincing proofs I see of this truth, that God governs in the affairs of men. Now, he went on in this way. He says, I firmly believe, if a sparrow cannot fall to the ground unseen by him, is it probable an empire can arise without his aid? I firmly believe this, and I also believe that without his concurring aid, we shall succeed in this political building